What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. In this episode, we sit down with the remarkable Mark Whitaker, a former executive turned whistleblower, whose life story is nothing short of a roller coaster ride into the worlds of corporate intrigue, FBI investigations, and personal redemption. Mark Whitaker's journey unfolds as a gripping narrative marked by his pivotal role in exposing a massive price-fixing scandal that rocked the business world to its core. Rising through the ranks as a high-profile executive, Mark found himself at the heart of a conspiracy that led him to make an extraordinary decision, becoming an undercover informant for the FBI. This decision, however, came with immense personal costs, including wearing a wire for 3 years and battling the pressures of mental health challenges, which we certainly discuss. Listeners will gain insights into the complexities of corporate ethics, the challenges of whistleblowing, and the toll it took on Mark's personal life, from the highs of corporate success to the lows of imprisonment and personal redemption. Mark Whitaker's story is a testament to resilience, courage, and the enduring quest for justice. We discuss all of this, as well as a movie that's based on his life, The Informant, released in 2009, with Matt Damon playing Mark Whitaker. And now I give you my former interviewee, Mark Whitaker.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Mark Whitaker. Mark, thanks for joining me again.
Yeah, great to see you again, Josh.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. I was looking in my podcast history. We were talking about this before I hit record. You were apparently the third interview I ever did way back in 2018. And now I'm well over 100. I think I'm actually inching close to 200. So I wanted to share that with you before we moved on to other topics.
Very good. Very exciting. Look forward to share again with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to ask you all my goofy questions. So yeah, it's great to see you. Obviously, I want to discuss, you know, you, ADM, Matt Damon later on. We'll get there. And of course, Second Chances and Redemption, which I'm really excited to talk about this time. Before we scale all that ground, Mark, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I'm Mark Whitaker, Vice President of Culture and Care for Coca-Cola Consolidated, largest bottler in America. Coca-Cola products. We have 300 different beverages. A lot of people think it's Coke and Diet Coke, but it's Mind My Water, Smart Water, Fairlife Milk. And I mean, it's amazing how many products, Minute Maid and High C, and 300 different beverages that we manufacture and bottle and distribute.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you, Mark.
But Vice President of Culture and Care is more on the people side. We're a very purpose-driven company, a little unique for a publicly traded company. Our official purpose statement, this will kind of tell quite a bit to your audience. Our official purpose statement at Coca-Cola Consolidated is to honor God in all we do by serving others, pursuing excellence, and growing profitably. But think about that, publicly traded company with a purpose statement, official purpose statement to honor God in all we do by serving others.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you, Mark. So I'd love to just wind the clock back, Mark. Something I meant to ask you in our last interview, and I didn't get around to it, unfortunately. What was it that initially drew you to biochemistry, and why did you pursue a PhD at Cornell?
You know, even in high school, I was really interested in the sciences, and I can remember having a guest speaker in ninth grade from University of Cincinnati. I grew up about 30 minutes north of Cincinnati. There was a PhD scientist that was one of our guest speakers. So I really liked science. It started in high school, and then in college, I really flourished in the sciences. Ohio State University, bachelor's and master's, PhD in biochemistry, specializing in nutritional biochemistry at Cornell in New York. But was very interested in sciences, really starting in high school with one guest speaker during my ninth grade in high school.
Wonderful. So maybe I just set the scene a little bit for our listeners here, Mark. What was Archer Daniels Midland and what brought you over to them?
Yeah, I was with a company called DeGoose, and now called Avonic, also a very large company, not much smaller than ADM. I was a couple of years in New York with them, and then I was 4 years in Frankfurt, Germany, a place we lived in, a little town called Hanau, Germany, about 20 miles south of Frankfurt, and very large chemical, very large biotech company. And I became eventually became vice president of their chemicals division at DeGusa, and I was doing joint ventures in that position. And I was actually doing some joint ventures with Archer Daniels Midland with ADM when I was in Frankfurt, Germany. So I got to know the CEO of ADM, the COO of ADM, and almost a couple years together working on joint ventures together, where I got to know them to the point they were very encouraged by me. And the CEO of ADM was 75 years old. The president of ADM was 69. And they'd offered a position to me as divisional president of the biotech division and corporate vice president of the company. And I was 32 years of age.
Wow.
7 years out of college at that point.
That's incredible. Now, I think if I remember correctly, weren't you the youngest executive at the time by decades?
Yeah, youngest divisional president level, youngest divisional president. I was divisional president, corporate vice president of the company, divisional president of the biotech division, and an officer of the company. So it was the youngest in that position at age 32. Most of them were pretty much in their mid-40s and up.
Excellent. So, Mark, you mentioned the culture where you're at now, Coca-Cola. So it compels me to want to ask you, what was the culture like at ADM at the time?
Boy, it was a different culture. And I realize we're talking 34 years ago when I joined them in 1989. So I really want to be clear, it'd be a different company today. And I want to be clear too, there were 30,000 hardworking people there even then, doing the right thing morally and ethically every day. It was kind of four bad apples at the top, but it was poor leadership, but it wasn't a bad company. It was a great company, just like it is today. We were number 56 on the Fortune 500. $70 billion in revenue, one of the largest food additive companies in the world. And the amazing opportunity for me was my age. I was basically 30 to 40 years younger. Think about it, 75-year-old CEO, 71-year-old president. And I was basically between 30 to 40 years younger. The three executives that taught me, I was ranked number four executive in the company, had access to the JADs, the seven top executives, had access to the JABs. I had access to the JADs, was often, most often flew on a corporate jet, bought the CEO's home. I lived in a 13,000 square foot home with a 8-car garage and horse riding stables. I mean, it was a mansion. Our CEO lived in it, I think, almost 30 years. And prior to him, it was the home of John Daniels, who founded Archer Daniels Midland 100 years earlier. So it was, for a century, it was the home of the CEO of ADM. I thought, boy, if you own that home, you're eventually going to be the next CEO. And I owned that home at age 32.
That's incredible. Thank you, Mark.
So it was like Justin Bieber before Justin Bieber. The plane, the mansion, the 8-car garage. I had the 8 cars, the Ferrari, the 2 BMWs, 2 Mercedes. And I think it was really kind of what I thought, boy, this is the pinnacle of success. It was probably really the start of my self-destruction. It just became too much of a focus at that point.
Yeah.
The materialism, the bells and whistles became too much of the focus for me.
Right, right. I understand that. So yes, I would love to get into that. There's more to cover, obviously, but getting into lysine, the price fixing scandal and so on. And I think the way I want to cue it up, Mark, is by asking you for a mutual audience just to kind of tell us, What exactly is price fixing and why is it illegal and unethical?
Yeah, price fixing, Josh, is when competitors get together and agree on the amount of volume they're going to sell. And the only reason why you agree on the amount of volume you're going to sell is to where you're fixing the prices. The purpose is to raise the prices. And if you're all trying to sell more volume than what the market will consume, well, that's capitalism. That's what America was built on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why one can buy an iPhone or a car or a microwave or a TV at decent prices, because there's all this competition. And that's the law, to have this competition in capitalism. Basically, price fixing takes capitalism out of the equation. You're working with your competitors almost like they're a different division of the same company. And it's illegal. You're breaking antitrust laws because you're raising the prices artificially by this collusion and by working together, what's called an international cartel. And it's really the ones that are getting hurt or the victims are the consumers.
Right. And maybe you can, thank you. And then we can fold that in perhaps to the discussion about ADM. How is ADM involved in price fixing? And then also maybe at the end, Mark, if you could tell our listeners what lysine is.
Yeah, ADM, where I first started to get involved with the price fixing, because with division, and it was proven in court that price fixing was going on a decade before I even joined the company.
Yes.
But where I got involved with was a key ingredient in the biotech division. We were called the bioproducts division, but it was really the biotech side, the fermentation side. And one of our fermentation products that we fermented from corn was a product called lysine. And like most of our products at ADM, they go into the food additive side of things. Lysine was a little bit, and it went into the feed additive side. So we go to someone like a Tyson poultry, when your listeners are buying Tyson chicken at the store, we would have been an ingredient in the feed of those poultry that they're purchasing in the store, in turkeys too, broilers and chickens and turkeys. And lysine was an ingredient in that. It's about a $1 billion market. And that's where the management leadership started bringing me into, because that was a key ingredient in the division that I was responsible for, was price fixing of lysine, where we meet with our competitors, control the volume, bring the amount of sales each of us were selling, but move the price way up. And I mean, from 60 cents a pound to eventually $3.50 a pound.
Wow.
You know, we're making tens of millions. And on all the ingredients together, the company was making hundreds of millions extra by price fixing these ingredients. And the ones paying for that are the consumers. If Tyson has to pay higher for lysine, for example, or Kellogg's cereal has to pay higher for an ingredient, or an iced tea or an orange juice, well, they're basically going to increase the price to the consumer.
They'll,
because they have their
customer
profit margin, but right, it gets past the consumer. You have these companies, these food companies have their profit margins built in. So when they pay higher for the ingredients, the consumers are paying higher. So the ones that really paid, that were really the victims for this, paid the higher price, were the consumers. Every consumer that was going to the grocery store.
Wow, it's amazing. So then when you were brought into it, how were you made aware that this price fixing was going on? Did the C-levels take you aside and say, hey, Mark, speak in a quiet voice, I want to tell you this? Or how did that happen exactly?
Well, I was a couple of years with the company already. They made sure I was trustworthy and kind of part of the family. And like I said, I started off divisional president. And then a couple of years later, I was promoted to also corporate vice president of the company and an officer, in addition to being a divisional president of the biotech division. Like I said, it was called bioproducts, but it was really the biotech side of our business. And I remember them giving me a $100,000 check and a big set of stock options. And I wonder what it was for. It was not at a time that it was our normal performance review time. And then about an hour later, one of the C-suite executives, actually the vice chairman, came back to my office and said, Mark, you're part of the family now. Look at our age. You know, the president is in his 70s. The CEO is heading towards his 80s, and we need to have young people that we can pour into and mentor, and they take over some of our leadership activities. And one of the things we want to share with you, Mark, is about how we want to start bringing lysine in, as we do with some of our other ingredients, and start working with our competitors. And that's the first they told me about. And I was a couple of years with the company, but this was an hour after I received this huge bonus. Between the stock options and the $100,000 check, it was almost $1 million just that day. And, you know, I wasn't going to walk away, especially someone that's consumed by that materialism. So I wasn't going to walk away. So, I mean, they had me hook, line, and sinker, but that's when I was at the fork of the road. I should have left the company that day when they started sharing with me what I was going to have to do, is what they were going to mentor me to do. But I tell you, I just wasn't willing to walk away and leave all those benefits that I had in the company. I mean, I was one of the youngest and a high level number four executive, and they were talking to me about that day, starting that day, about eventually replacing our president and COO. So right. To go from divisional president to company president, because he was in his 70s. So I looked at it, this is an opportunity. Eventually, I could become the CEO several years down the road. And I just wasn't going to walk away.
Yeah, I think that's very human, Mark. It's not obvious to me that I wouldn't have done the same thing in your position.
Seven figures in my early 30s in the late 1980s.
It's not bad. That's not bad. So I'd love to know what it was for you that made you decide to become a whistleblower on this scandal.
Yeah, I want to be really clear about that. You know, I get referred to the highest level. Even still today, the FBI referred to me as the highest level executive to turn whistleblower in U.S. history. I've done 7 events for the FBI, including Quantico FBI Academy. You know, I think because of that. But in reality, and I do know they know this, but I was the one wearing the wire for 3 years for the FBI. But in reality, it was my wife, Ginger, that forced me to turn myself in to the FBI. Without my wife, Ginger, the largest price-fixing case, the largest antitrust case in history would have never happened. It's my wife, Ginger, when I shared with her 7 months as I was kind of on this journey being mentored, and I shared with her, that's when she put the hammer down and said, boy, you've got to turn yourself in or I'm going to turn you in. This is a fraud. This is illegal. This is not just unethical. This is illegal. People go to prison for breaking antitrust laws. And she said, Mark, you've got to turn yourself in. This was November 5th, 1992, or I'm going to do it. So really, I would say my wife was really probably reality, the whistleblower, my wife, Ginger, and I was the informant just collecting the evidence for the FBI.
Wow, that's wonderful. In its way, it's wonderful. She obviously loves you very much. Just a few more questions on that, Mark, then I will move on to other topics. But, you know, one thing that's always fascinated me about you, Mark, has been your decision to become a whistleblower while you yourself were involved in the whole embezzlement thing. For our listeners, I think the figure was something like $9.5 million that was embezzled at the time. So I'd love for you to talk about the mental decision or thought process you went through, you know, in going to the FBI, cooperating with the FBI, even with that hanging over your head.
Well, basically what happened there was a $640,000 investment that myself, the president of ADM Mexico, and one of the other vice presidents made, 3 of us made, and we made this investment, and it went south. And so we ended up reimbursing ourselves with company funds. This is actually before I met the FBI, for $640,000. So now all of a sudden I'm working with the FBI. So I knew that through with this procedure, this method, that 3 executives that we did to reimburse ourselves the $640,000 in total. So I'm working with the FBI, and then they're telling me, look, at the end of this, you're not going to be ADM. The CEO, it's his daughter's on the board, his son's on the board. This is a board of directors of family and friends. This is before the Sarbanes-Oxley bill that required independent boards. It came in 2002. Keep in mind, this is 1992, 10 years earlier. So they were not independent boards. Independent boards came about because of cases like this. So they said, look, you're not going to be able to work at ADM once this case goes public. And so I looked at it and thought, gosh, well, most of my income, 80, 90% of my income is in stock options. So I looked at how much my stock, especially these last 6-9 months when the FBI said they're getting down to their last year of the evidence collecting. We're wired for 3 years. We're getting down to the last year. And I had this fraud that I did for $640,000, which what I was giving the FBI would not have been a problem at all. All I had to do is tell the FBI about it. The fact I'm wearing a wire on this hundreds of millions of theft every year that's been going on for 12 years in a row, you know, the bigger price fixing cases, that it wouldn't have been a problem. But the fact I knew that method of how to do it, and the fact that I looked at my stock option, that they were about $9.5 million of stock options that the FBI told me were last year, and I was about 2 years away from exercising them. They were a 5-year set of stock options. So that's how I calculated that exact dollar amount, because I thought if it ever went to court, I could show documents that I have that I didn't have stock options that was going to be worth that much. So I knew the method before the FBI on this lot smaller case, on this $640,000, where the president of AD in Mexico and a vice president, you know, where three of us reimbursed ourselves. So I used that same method to basically steal my own severance, $9.5 million. All right. But with the overarching umbrella to think that I'm protected because I can show the FBI and legal authorities that I've got stock options signed by the CEO and the general counsel. They were going to owe me $9.5 million. The challenge was you can't reimburse you can't exercise your stock options that way. You have to wait till the actual exercise date, which would have been a year after that I was even no longer there. They fired me, obviously, the day they knew I was an informant. So it would have been a year later that I could exercise them. And there's a really formal procedures that the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, require that you follow. You just can't write five checks to yourself for $9.5 million. So it's the procedure I used. The FBI understood the reason behind it, but it was a fraud, the procedure I used. I just panicked. I just thought, who's going to hire someone where a wire gets their own company for 3 years? I'm in my 30s. It'd be easier to get a job as a felon than a whistleblower. So I thought, I'm not going to be employed. I had $9.5 million they owed me if I was there going to be there a year longer. And I thought I would capture what they owed me a year early. That was my thinking behind it.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yes. But it's a fraud because you exercise your own stock options.
Right.
A year prior to the exercise date, and that's where it became a fraud, right there.
That's where it became fraud. So interesting.
Full immunity. I had full immunity wearing a wire until that point.
Right, right. I know our listeners will not forgive me if I don't ask you this question. I'd love to know if there was a specific time over the course of your wearing this wire, Mark, when you thought ADM executives might have discovered you.
Oh, yeah, it was. The FBI told me, and they even did a documentary, the three FBI agents that I worked undercover with, even did a documentary, even sharing about this on Discovery Channel about a few months after the movie came out in 2009. And basically, they were combating the movie. They felt the movie missed some of the seriousness of the case.
So right.
It's a documentary, and my wife and I are on that documentary along with the FBI. And in that documentary, they were clear that, Mark, if these guys get you, they're going to get you. This is serious stuff. And to hear that 2 or 3 times a week for 3 years took a huge toll on me. Just worried about what's going to happen someday when I'm a federal witness against them, or if they find me, you know, wearing a wire when I was undercover.
Right. And it's probably worth pointing out, you know, that at the time you also had, you know, undiagnosed bipolar.
Yes, I did. I did. I got bipolar. I attempted suicide after wearing a wire for 3 years and was diagnosed with bipolar. But at this point, the undercover years are done. The fraud was done. And then I got diagnosed and then treated. And you made a huge difference. But at this point, all the damaging things have already been done.
I'd love to ask you, Mark, what was it then that finally led you to prison?
Yeah, I had basically, after wearing a wire for 3 years, I had full immunity. Until the $9.5 million fraud came about, the company immediately, when they learned I was the whistleblower, you know, they're promoting me prior to this.
Right.
But once they knew I was the one wearing a wire, they called the FBI immediately and shared about the $9.5 million. Said, look at this. He did this same time he's working for the FBI. So the FBI were still so supportive. They knew I wasn't thinking clearly. They knew the logic of the stock options, you know, that really the company was going to owe me that dollar amount a year later. And they knew the pressure I was wearing a wire for 3 years. So they got me a 6-month plea agreement, 6 months in federal prison. A Martha Stewart sentence, no razor wire. And I never forget, my wife, we're in front with my lawyer in the office, and my wife by my side. He said, you got a 6-month plea agreement. Mark, this is unbelievable for a $9.5 million fraud. A miracle. Deal of a lifetime. And I said, I don't know if I could do 6 months in prison. I was 38 years old at the time. And Ginger looked at me. She said, Mark, I'm begging you to sign it. Let's put this behind you. You go into prison at age 38. You come out at age 38. Let's put it behind us. And I looked at Ginger and said, Ginger, it's your fault I'm in this mess in the first place. I had to wear wire 3 years because of you, Ginger. And I ripped up that plea agreement. I fired the attorney and then fought the case for 3 years through the courts and ended up getting 8.5 years on a 10-year sentence. With a 10-year federal sentence, there's no parole in the federal system. You get 15% off good behavior. So you have to do an 8.5-year sentence on a 10-year sentence. So I did 8.5 years and I would add 6 months for that mistake. So I went from full immunity, huge mistake, deal of a lifetime, got 6 month sentence. I ripped it up, threw it away, and got 8.5 years instead.
Wow.
3 years later. So I would have went to prison, got out at 38. Instead, I was going in at 40 and getting out at 48.
I have the dumb question of the day for you, Mark. If you could go back and reconsider that plan, what would you do?
If I would go back, I would go back even further. And when they said, Mark, this is after they gave me the stock and a $100,000 check, about $1 million between the two, and they brought me into the price fixing, I would have walked away then.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have walked away even then. But I tell you, Josh, I just want to kind of for your listeners, I became a Christian in that journey to the point where my wife shares even publicly. We just did an event October 5th at the Charlotte annual prayer breakfast event. Both of us together on stage. We do these often each year, these type of events where you share testimonies. And she said, if I signed that 6 month sentence, as mad as she was then, and she even said murder was on the table, even though divorce wasn't, as mad as she was then, she says, thank God he didn't sign it. I don't think he would have listened to Ian Howes and Chuck Colson. That's two gentlemen that reached out to me where I became a Christian. And it changed my life forever. So she feels like I may have lost for what I would have become a Christian and would be going to heaven when life here on earth is done with. But I think I would have lost my family. I think it saved everything. Life, eternity for me, it saved my family because it transformed my life. And with a 6 month sentence, I don't believe I would have become a Christian. I would have looked at my watch when Chuck Colson and Ian Howes reached out and I said, I'm out of here in 6 months. But when you got 8.5 years out of you, you're hopeless, you're helpless, and you're broken. And I needed to be broken at that time in my life. So as painful as it was, there's a lot of good that came out of that.
It's fascinating, the blessings in disguise that pervade our life. You stole my next question already, Mark, but I think I'll ask you clearly. If that name Chuck Colson blew by our listeners a little too quickly, that's, of course, the infamous aide to Richard Nixon. And then perhaps I'll ask you, if there isn't any more ground to cover there, how was he significant to you? What did he do to convert you?
Yeah, I tell you, Chuck Colson was so, two guys, really. Ian Howes reached out to me before prison and planted a very important seed. He was part of a group called CBMC, Christian Businessman Connection. And then Chuck Colson, who reached out, started my second week in prison in 98. So I was 40 years of age. And 25 years ago, and when he reached out, Chuck, I told him about the Bible study that I was already in the last 7 months with this gentleman named Ian Howes. He said, Mark, if you surrendered your life to Jesus, if you become a Christian, and I said, I want to, and I've got hope, but I've got 8 years of college telling me there's no God. I never met one Christian professor in 8 years of college, Ohio State nor Cornell. Matter of fact, I had some professors say, if you're a Christian, you can't be a PhD scientist. So I heard that a lot. So I kind of started thinking my parents were Christians when I was in college because they didn't go to college. They don't know better. So I had 8 years of college telling me it's evolution and Darwinism and Big Bang Theory. Think about biochemistry. It's all the hard sciences, especially in a secular university. There was nothing about God. And Chuck Colson is he passed in 2012, but White House counsel under President Nixon, had an office in the Oval Office in his 30s, right next to the Oval Office in his 30s. Remarkable man. And he reached out to me. He became a Christian in prison in the 70s during the Watergate scandal. And he reached out to me, and he basically started showing me some of the best scientists in the world that believed in God. Even Albert Einstein wrote an article that only God could create man and only God could create the universe. And Sir Isaac Newton wrote as much about God as he did about science. And Chuck Colson, just article after article and book after book, showed me things the universities never showed me about some of the best scientists that believe in God. Even Francis Collins, who discovered the human genome, he's a Christian. They never talked about that at Cornell. So I became a Christian my first year in prison when he really showed me the facts. And it changed my life forever. Huge impact. God used him to have a huge impact on my life.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, Francis Collins, an extremely devout and serious Christian. I'm well aware of Dr. Collins. So then, love to get into it then, Mark, about second chances. So talk about, please, being released from prison and how Cypress Systems entered your life.
Yeah, I tell you a little bit. It even started when I was in prison, this did. I started using my education once I became a Christian in 98, my first year of prison. I helped guys get their GEDs. I helped some of them get two-year degrees in through a correspondence class that they offered free to inmates. I helped Spanish guys speak better English and write better English. And I'm $20 a month. Keep in mind, I'm seven figures for 8 years.
At right.
Now I'm $20 a month for 8 years, and they became the most productive years of my life. Because for the first time in my life, I was helping someone else besides myself. And I saw how rewarding servant leadership was. So when I got out of prison almost 20 years ago, I wanted to continue that track. And Cornell University, one of those professors became a Christian, and he introduced me to the CEO of a company called Cypress Systems, a biotechnology company. And the CEO started visiting me in prison. They had me review his patents, review his strategic plan. So it kind of kept my mind active. And they offered me a job the day I got out of prison. And I started like the level of someone right out of college. And I eventually became the COO of that company for almost a decade. And I'm still on their advisory board even today, 20
wow.
years later. So God created an opportunity. I was learning HVAC because I wanted to be able to support my family. I thought, am I ever going to be get employed with a PhD in biochemistry, being a convicted felon? Maybe not. So I learned HVAC in prison.
Huh.
And I learned it well. But it's amazing how God gave me another opportunity in the biotech world with the skill sets I had. I mean, only God could do that.
No, indeed. Indeed. Wow, that's wonderful. So I suppose, and unfailingly, we have to talk about Matt Damon. So how was it that the movie The Informant came to be made about your ADM experience with, of course, Matt Damon playing you in the movie? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, there's three books written on the ADM case. The first one that came out was the book, The Informant, came out really my first year when I was in prison by a New York Times writer. Another one is called Rats in the Grain by an antitrust lawyer. Two different books. I think the book, The Informant, was written more like a movie script, and the Rats in the Grain was a little bit more like a documentary. The FBI feel, if you look 100 years down the road, probably the more documented, more accurate book is Rats in the Grain. It is. And had two different perspectives. And then my wife and I wrote a book in 2009 called Mark Whitaker Against All Odds. We hired a ghostwriter, H. Duman Hoover, that shared our faith journey, like what we're sharing now, sharing the rest of the story. Because the other two books came out right when I went to prison. So they end, Mark Whitaker goes to prison. So our book kind of shares the last, 25, 30 years of her life and how God's really blessed us through that darkness. But that's how The Informant came about. And it is written like a movie script. Steven Soderbergh loved the book, especially the fact it was so much like a script. He did a movie called The Informant, same as the book name. And he made it a little, the book is more like Reading the Firm, more like a very serious drama. But the movie, he kind of put a little bit more comedic twist. When he bought the rights from New York Times, or from Kurt Eichenwald of the New York Times, when he bought the rights to do the movie of the book, The Insider had come out, the big tobacco case against Brown Williamson, whistleblower case. And that was the same year he bought the rights of The Informant book. And that was a serious drama. And he didn't want to be compared. He told us this at the premiere. He didn't want to be compared to Michael Mann to do the same movie. One is food. The other one's big tobacco. So he kind of turned this Kurt Eichenwald's book a little bit more into a dark comedy in order it not to be compared to The Insider. That's how it became the comical twist to it.
Awesome. Awesome. Understood. Yeah. And then, the obvious physical characteristics aside, how did Matt Damon come to be involved?
Yeah, they chose Matt Damon. They wanted someone to be very likable, lovable. And Matt Damon just does movies that are really likable characters. And they chose him. We got to meet him. We got to meet his wife, Luciana. Mm-hmm. And we got to share a little bit of the rest of our story, too, our faith journey. And we gave him a copy of our Mark Whitaker Against Odds, our book that came out the month of the movie of our faith journey. And we met a lot of the actors and the director. And it was interesting. Now the director is not a Christian. He's publicly, you know, Mitch shares that he's an atheist. So he wasn't interested in the Chuck Colson and becoming a Christian in prison. He wanted a crime drama. He wanted it entertaining. And that's the movie he produced that came out in 2009.
Very well done. It's a great movie. You know, since you and I last spoke a few years ago, Mark, I've had the honor of interviewing many people that have had movies made about their lives. I've interviewed, you know, Valerie Plame, Jackie Callen, you know, plenty. Squandered the opportunity last time you and I spoke, but I'm not going to do it this time. I'd love to know how surreal it is to have a movie made about your life where you're seeing yourself on the screen, but it's a parody of your life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was, you know, keep in mind, this is after 3 years wearing a wire, 8 years of prison, you know, when the movie came out. So we just felt so blessed. I was already COO and president of Cyprus, you know, almost 3 years in that position by the time the movie came out. So we were in a different place in our life. I tell you, my wife and I could relate to kind of the comical twist to it. We could relate to the book, showing the seriousness of it. They even filmed like me blowing the driveway off at 3 a.m. because of the pressure with a gas leaf blower during thunderstorms. They took that out. They filmed the suicide attempt at our house. They took that out. They just felt like it didn't fit the comical, you know, the fact it was a comedy. But I think it would have been better if it left that in. And I know the FBI felt like it lost some of that too. And that's why they did the documentary called Undercover on Discovery Channel, really to combat the movie, to show the seriousness of what this case really was.
Right.
So I think the documentary and the movie together really share the story. I think the documentary fills in the holes.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. I agree with that. I've seen the documentary. So then, obviously, since we last spoke, Mark, obviously you're with Coca-Cola now. I see you wearing a lovely Coca-Cola vest. I'd love to know how that opportunity came about and what's it been like for you.
Oh, it's been great. I'm not doing any biochemistry anymore at all, like I did at Cyprus. I'm still on the advisory board at Cyprus, still today, but I'm vice president of culture and care. Been on almost 5 years now, since 2019 at Coca-Cola Consolidated. We're a faith-friendly, very purpose-driven company, and vice president of culture and care, our department's responsible for the culture that impacts retention rates and absenteeism and employee engagement. And it's been a great season. We have a chaplain in every plant, 104 bottling plant sites, dozens of prayer groups and Bible studies and discipleship and mentorship, all including faith. And it's a really neat season. It has been.
Well, that's
and they were one of the victims. The amazing thing is I'm married 44 years, and there's not many marriages who survive prison. I mean, it's a miracle of God.
Right.
Married 44 years to Ginger, the very woman who forced me to turn myself into the FBI. Miracle of God. I worked for a company that was one of the victims. ADM, and during the price-fixing case, class action suits, they had to pay $400 million just to the beverage industry and to Coca-Cola for the corn sweetener price-fixing. It was their largest class action suit of all, was the $400 million, even four times the size of lysine. And I'm working for a company 30 years later that was a victim in my case and vice president and officer. It's a miracle of God. Only God could do this.
Absolutely. It's absolutely incredible, Mark. I couldn't be happier for you. I suppose perhaps my last question, Mark, obviously we've covered a lot. I'd love to ask you, what's next for you?
I'm in a season. I'd love to do this a long time. We're spending a lot of time mentoring younger executives that are going to be the next leadership, that will be the next vice presidents and the next senior vice presidents. And at some point we'd be the next CEO and COO of Coca-Cola. We have 17,000 employees. We have 1,800 positions open now that will take us closer to 19,000 employees and teammates. And it's such a great season. I can't imagine doing anything else. This is the chapter that I believe really God, that all of these 30 years, this journey has really built me for.
That's wonderful, Mark. That's wonderful. I'm happy for you. Well, Mark Whitaker, how can people find out about you, sir?
I have a website, markwhitaker.com. It is spelled W-H-I-T-A-C-R-E. So www.markwhitaker.com has my email address is also on there. But I do have a website that shares even the documentary. It has a little bit of the movie on there, too, and has my testimony on there. But there's quite a bit of information on markwhitaker.com.
Wonderful. Mark, my friend, it was such a pleasure speaking with you again, man. I really appreciate you taking the time for me.
Hey, you too, Josh. Thanks for having me again. A great catching up.
You too, my friend. You take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. We can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.